All right. Welcome to Men's Roundtable. My name is Bill. I am one of the pastors here at Grace. If you're new or visiting from another church, my wife Rachel and I are here. I've been on staff for about 6 years and on our teaching team. I'm a father of four sons, so sometimes I'll joke and say I feel like I've been living in a man factory for the last 20 years or so. And a lot of my life has been devoted to the question of what is a man and how do we help our boys transition into becoming men. So Men's Roundtable is really near and dear to my heart. It's played an incredibly important role in the formation of my sons and in equipping me as a dad to really help my boys become men. So I'm excited. I'm glad you're all here. I'm glad that we have elders who take seriously this call, and I believe it is really important for future generations of men and women. So I'm really excited to be with you as we launch into this third or fourth session of the quest for authentic manhood, where we deal with the idea of the mother wound. So you can take your notes and just kind of follow along. We're gonna work through them line by line. So for those of y'all who like to fill in the gaps, and it proves, if you're married, it proves to your wife you were here and you were paying attention, she'll feel good about that. So you go ahead and do that, take good notes, and we'll work our way through. But as we get started, whenever I do this talk, I want to kind of brag about my mom a little bit. So we could play a game, my mom's tougher than your mom. Tough moms have been the source of great tragedy and great comedy. In my case, my mom is pretty unusual. She's the youngest of 9 children, only 7 of whom survived. She is a survivor of polio. Her mother died of cancer when she was 6, and her father, who was not a good man, took her and dropped her off at a children's home and abandoned her. She stayed there for 4 years until her oldest brother had the resources to be able to rescue her from that situation. She went and slept on his couch for a while and eventually got a room and worked her way through high school, where she was the student body president, the homecoming queen, captain of the cheerleading squad, worked second shift in a textile mill to pay for her wedding to a man who was not my dad. And while she was working second shift in that mill, my father was given the responsibility of training her. She fell in love with him, kept that a secret. She hid in the bushes, jumped in the back of his convertible, ran off to elope with him. Had all that blown apart because they couldn't get a marriage license real quickly, and had to come back and face her family and her former fiance. She still had the strength to work all the way through that. They convinced her she was running off with poor white trash, and what was she thinking? She weathered all of that, ended up marrying my father, and here I am. And all of that, she never complained about anything. Never heard my mom. I didn't even realize she'd had a difficult childhood until I got older and began to connect all of the dots, because she wasn't embittered by any of that. So if you got a better story than that, I would love to hear it, but it's one of the best stories I've ever heard. That's my mom. So she's a tough lady, a powerful woman, and has had obviously a huge impact on me. Hadn't always been easy, but I always knew that women had this deep and difficult to understand, even mysterious power. And I experienced that with my mom, and then as I grew older as a man, I began to understand other dimensions of that. But when we're thinking about the mother wound and the impact that a mom can have on her son, for good or ill, we need to understand a little bit first about biblical femininity. And here's where we'd start. I've also been privileged not just to work with what we do with our men at our church, but I've also been privileged for the last 3 years now to be really engaged in helping lead a process with the women of our church where we develop a theology and language of femininity to be a tool to equip our women to understand who God's made them to be and how they can put those gifts and that unique strength that God's entrusted to them, how they can put that in play in the core relationships of their life and in the world so that they're serving God in a way that's consistent with what it means to be a woman. So that's been an incredible privilege. It's been difficult, been a lot of awkward moments, as you can imagine. There have been times where I've been a man teaching other women how to be a woman, and I'm not ideally suited for that, but I've been a part of a lot of conversations that have been great. And the core of that, and I think it's helpful for you to understand this, is the core of that idea is that in Genesis chapter 2, when God created men and women, he created a man out of the earth and for the earth in order to represent God's authority and to begin to work in the world to represent God's authority and make the world a better place. But as the man was made and put into the world, his gifts are put in play in the world. God gives him commands. He gives him direction. He begins to work. In the middle of that environment where there's no sin, the man has meaningful work. He's in fellowship with God. The Lord says, it is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable, is the way most translations translate it in Genesis 2. I'll make a helper suitable, but the Hebrew is, I will make an ezer kenegdo. And a better way of talking about it is not so much helper, because in our culture, helper has this kind of patronizing and condescending idea to it. And so somebody's going to be daddy's little helper. Go home, if you're married, and call your wife daddy's little helper. Well, isn't that nice of you, daddy's little helper? See how that goes for you. It's not going to be received well. It's not going to be received well because that feels like condescension. A better way to understand that idea of ezer being the core of biblical femininity is a woman is created to be a counterpart, one who brings strength that is missing. In the Old Testament, where that Hebrew word is used, it usually refers to, a number of times it refers to God being the one who comes alongside his people in their distress and brings the strength that they need, the strength that they are missing. The word kenegdo comes alongside, and it has this idea of essential. And so what we're talking about is there is that the man, in order for the image of God to be completed, in order for God's purposes in the world to be fulfilled, there needed to be a unique kind of strength that was masculine. But then out of the man, God created an essential counterpart, one who had a strength that was missing and who was created out of the man to correspond to the man, to be able to come alongside him. And so we have right now, over the last year, we've had about 1,000 women in our church participate in the first, the foundational study for our women's ministry, which is called Ezer. What it means in defining that idea and giving some language to the idea of what it means to be female in the image of God. And so even as we're learning what it means to be male in the image of God and the core calling for us to lead, to own responsibility, to lead courageously, to reject passivity, and to do all of that in expectation of God's reward, so we're also trying to come up with some language for our women and to equip them and also to help our men and women relate better. Now, nowhere is this seen within the context of marriage is very powerful. But in the short term, I would argue that this idea of what it means to be one who comes alongside and brings strength, I don't know that it's seen anywhere more clearly than in the relationship between a young boy who is virtually defenseless, who isn't yet, doesn't have a fully formed masculinity yet, who's not self-aware, who doesn't really understand what it means to be a man, and in the level of dependence that young boy has on the woman who gave birth to him, and the degree of power and control that she has over him, the level of influence that she has, the degree to which he needs her is unparalleled at any other point in time. And we could talk about a man's need for his wife sexually, and certainly that is incredibly powerful. But his life doesn't depend on that. But there are some very real senses in which a young boy, his life depends on his mom. And that puts her in this position of primacy over him, where she defines reality for him. And so with all of that power, when you have that kind of power, there comes the opportunity presents itself for that to turn toxic. For instead of that being empowering and launching, for that to become a means of control and for it to become domination, not even with evil intentions, but in a fallen world where our desires are corrupted And even moms' desires are corrupted in relationship to their children. And for many of them, they aren't very self-aware of that. And so they're wielding all of this power many times in an unreflective manner. And they're wielding it over a really malleable and a weak future man, a boy. And he's overmatched and he's dependent. And so what can happen in that, if we were to define the mother wound, here's what we would say, is that the mother wound is an unhealthy intimacy with mom that can cause a couple of reactions. So if we just simplify and say the mother wound is an unhealthy intimacy with mom that typically can cause a couple of reactions. Now let me before we talk about those two reactions, let's talk about this idea, an unhealthy intimacy. There are moms who abandon their children, and that leaves a deep wound. And we're not going to spend a bunch of time talking about that because that tends to be less prevalent, and we have a limited amount of time that we're pressing these things in. So that's a separate issue that we would have to deal with on a more personal level. So if that's where you are, then I would suggest that talking to your pastor, talking to one of your pastors, talking to a counselor to get some hooks to work on that, we're not going to have the opportunity to really deal with that. Because most of what we deal with is this overbonding with mom, where mom looms so large and there aren't any checks on all of that, and for whatever reason, she imposes herself and crosses over some boundaries, and an unhealthy intimacy develops, and it tends to result in two ways, poles, two opposite poles on the end of the continuum. One end of that would be an over-identification with the feminine, and the other end of that would be a rejection of that which is feminine and a really hypersensitivity towards being controlled by a woman and a domineering approach. So on the one hand, a man can be feminized, and I'm going to qualify that. We're not talking about being effeminate, but he can be feminized in some ways so that the core of his masculinity is gutted in some areas by his ongoing dependence on and need for his mom. It creates an unhealthy dependence on women. And on the other side, it can be a man who senses that something is going on, and he begins to feel that he's being controlled. Certain personality types especially are that way. This is kind of where I was with a really strong mom. And being someone who is naturally pretty directional, I like to make decisions. I like to chart my own course. I need a lot of freedom. I'm pretty independent by nature. That I began to feel oppressed by all of that, and I reacted against it and was determined no one was going to control me. Both of those ends of the spectrum can be an expression of the mother wound. And here's, let me kind of flesh it out a little bit for you. And I'm going to spend most of the time talking about the feminization side because that's mostly what we seem to be dealing with in our culture. In our church, this is rampant. And a lot of the way that it will express itself, and we'll back our way into it, is a woman will come in deep frustration about her husband. And they've been married for 12 years. They have 3 children that are pretty young. She feels like he is not leading in their home. He's a nice guy, and he has some great, he's got manly hobbies even. He's a hunter, he's a fisher, he's into sports. All of that seems really normal. But at the core of who he is, there is an absence of distinctively masculine energy. He is no longer pursuing his wife very aggressively. And some of that may be because she's not safe to pursue, but he's gotten kind of passive in that area. He doesn't have real plans for the family. He doesn't make directions. He doesn't carry a lot of weight. And she feels oppressed, like she's handling on all these responsibilities with the children, and she needs him to carry his stuff, but she's not even really confident that he's got that. And he goes to his job, but there's not a lot of energy in his job. And as we have worked and worked and worked, what we have found a lot of times is that the root of that is he has come to really need feminine direction And he thinks more like a woman, generally speaking, and not all women are this way, but women tend to be web thinkers. There have been psychological and sociological studies done on this. Even the shapes of the female brain in certain centers in the women in a woman's brain are formed differently because of the hormones that are raging through the body, even while the baby is still in utero, but then in the first couple years of a woman's life, brains are even formed differently. And a man who has been dominated by that, he will begin to think more that way, and he will have a difficult time making decisions. He needs tons of affirmation from a woman. He is always looking for consensus, and that may work really well, and this is what we find with some of those women when we're dealing with it. That may work really well in the early stages of a relationship because it feels good to her, and she's really happy that he always cares about what she thinks, and he listens, and she's got ideas, and he may not have that many ideas about where he'd like to go, and she's got all these dreams, and he gets on board with her dreams, and he's really kind of following her. And in reality, what's happened is, he never really severed the apron strings. He never really severed the umbilical cord. And what happened is he took the umbilical cord out of his mom and he affixed it to this girl while they were dating, and then they moved on. And all that while it felt affirming to her because she was needed and she had a voice and she really appreciated all of that. But then when their life got more complicated, and she is burdened with responsibilities and concerns for the future, and she needs a man to just be an equal partner with her and create some space for her to do her thing and just go handle it. And she just wants the decisions to be made and things to be followed through on. And she doesn't have time to be engaged in all of that. She begins to resent what she used to love. And so 10, 12, 13 years in, depending on when they have children and if they have children, she begins to suddenly realize, I need someone to protect me, someone to provide for me, someone to really pursue me, to be more aggressive with me, and he doesn't know how to do that. And so they're both mystified as to why it's not working. As you can tell, by the way, that I communicate that story, the details, I can nuance it a whole lot of different ways, but the idea is that at the root of that, most of the time, what we will find is that there is a mother wound, and many times that mom, even in that situation, one of the real things that's grating on the relationship is that he still is caught between his wife and his mom, and he feels powerless, and he feels like a victim because his mom is still trying to run him in some ways, and he's trying to make her happy, and his wife is trying to run him in some ways. He's trying to make her happy, and he doesn't have a clear sense of who he is and a direction for his future. That is unbelievably common. And I would argue that in our culture, even our school systems tend to reinforce that. They typically, especially our elementary schools, are a very feminized environment. And a lot of times, almost all of the teachers and the administrators are all women. And so there is a lot, even in those environments, that's hostile towards masculine ways of thinking and learning even, where sitting quietly is rewarded, where learning is not very tactile. I remember one time one of my children got in trouble at school, and we found out he had done all his work. He was sitting in his class, and he had to move his butterfly, which let's just acknowledge that a six-year-old boy, the idea of moving my butterfly as being disciplined doesn't make any sense to me. Like if we had a little cutout figure of a man and he got a bullet hole put through him, that would make sense to him. Or we stuck arrows in him, that would make sense. But I have to move my butterfly. So even that metaphor doesn't work for him. His little purple butterfly got moved with his name on it. Which, what little boy wants to be a purple butterfly? I don't know. Not a healthy one. So he's got to move his butterfly. He's feeling all this shame. We ask him, what actually happened to you in your classroom today? And what happened to him was he had finished his work and nothing was going on. And he very quietly just slid out of his desk because he wanted to see how his desk was put together from underneath. He was wondering how the legs were held on, and he was just exploring the environment that he was put in. And so in a culture like that, where you already have a mom who has all this power and maybe has not been trained to think about the positive and negative consequences of some of that, it's just assumed that it's all positive. And our boys who are being educated, whether they're in Christian or public schools or even being homeschooled, they have a woman authority in their life at this for this incredibly long period of time. which in most of human history, it would not have been that way. But now that's the way it is. We are dealing with a lot of men who have been softened by that. And so outwardly, they may be macho. They may have all of the stuff that's going on. Did I just say macho? It's kind of an old word, 70s. All right. So you know what I'm talking about, though. So they may have all of that going on the outside, but at the root, there's a piece that's missing, and they're mystified by it. And they're not in touch with that. And they are beginning to realize that they think more like a woman. They don't feel powerful in ways that men should distinctively feel powerful. That's this epidemic. Now, before we go any further and we kind of unpack this idea and work through the characteristics of the mother wing that you have there in front of you, let me just say this. This is not a let's bash our moms or let's bash women session. That's not what this is about. Because there's not a one of us who is in the room who understands what it's like to be a life factory. I cannot imagine what that would be like. I mean, by the time a boy is 1 year old, his mom has had him for 21 months. And if she's done what pediatricians will tell you is probably the best thing for him, she's nursed him for the first year of his life, then here's what's happened. Going all the way back to the moment of conception, her body has been the sole source of protection and life for him. He spent 9 months growing inside of her, and through this incredible and mysterious ability, everything that he needed for life, from the protections of disease in the world to the nutrition that he needs to the oxygen that he needs. A woman's body is so created in such an amazing way that even if a mom has a different blood type from her child, she is capable of passing oxygen through the placenta without any exchange of blood. She gives him everything that he needs. And she knows the rhythms of even when he sleeps, when he's awake, when he's moving, when he's not moving. That's 9 months. Then she gives birth to him in great pain and risk to herself. We don't think about this anymore, but the courage involved just in giving birth, the risk that is. Just go to graveyards and look throughout human history. Look just a couple generations ago and see how many of the graves are moms and babies. A very dangerous thing that we take for granted with modern medicine, but very dangerous. So she's encountered all this peril, and then with all that pain, her body being stretched out of shape, all that goes along with that, her life forever altered by that, then she spends a year where she provides him with all the nutrition that his body needs to grow healthily, where she provides for him antibodies through her breast milk, so that her immune system becomes his immune system and gives him a jump start in life. She is protecting him and providing for him in a way that we cannot begin to imagine. And the psychological bond that takes place in all of that, we need to not despise. So it's an incredible thing. And we need to be careful to respect that and recognize that when she's created to come alongside and live life, to give life, to invite, to nurture, and to partner, to strengthen, she's wired up to do all of that. She's been a source of life for him. It's going to be difficult for her to allow distance to begin to be created in that relationship. It's going to be painful in a way that it isn't painful for us. And I can attest to that. My sons are beginning to move out of the house, and I can just tell you that for me, it just feels like one less big, stinky guy in the house. Now, I think if I had daughters, I would probably feel differently, and I'm really close to my sons. But they're men. It's good for them. Getting a bull out of the pasture into his own pasture is a good thing, categorically, for me. It feels good. It feels right. I'm proud of them. I'm launching them. I'm enjoying spending time with them. We connect. We meet at Waffle House. We meet for dinner. We hang out. We talk about things. We go to ball games together. We watch a movie together. We do all the things that we ever did before. But for my wife, him leaving is a grief in a way that it isn't a grief for me. And I miss him sometimes, but it's on a deeper level. And we need to show respect for that and not despise it. And to that end, most of the time when this mother wound is being inflicted, Let's kind of view what it really is. It's a wound that's not blatant. If you look in your notes, it's not blatant, but subtle most of the time. Now, there are times Bobby Boucher's mom is pretty over the top. All right, Kathy Bates plays that character great in that movie. If you haven't seen The Waterboy, it's a great example of a mother wound. Not very subtle, but that's comedy. That's part of what makes it funny. But most of the time, that's an exaggeration of something. We recognize it. We can laugh about it. But the reality is that most of the time, this wound is not blatant, but it's subtle. It's not a wound of abuse or neglect or absenteeism most of the time, but it's a wound that's disguised as love and care. It isn't a wound of inattention, but of overattention. It looks like love, and to her, it feels like love, but to him, it feels like control, because there are boundaries that are being crossed over. And it's a wound that's so powerful that it can shape or warp the masculine psyche. Now, let's just give a handful of illustrations for what this can look like. It's not a wound of inattention, but of overattention. It feels like it's disguised as love and care. You see this all the time. I'll just give you an illustration. How about moms who are so into their children having a boyfriend or a girlfriend, or even not having a boyfriend or a girlfriend, that they're just so engaged in that part of their life that they're asking questions all the time. They're hyper-vigilant because they love their children. They don't want them to make mistakes, or they love their children, and they want their children to feel loved and valued, so they want them to have the right boyfriend, the popular guy, the popular girl, whatever it is. It shocks me what I see parents doing on Facebook in relationship to their kids and connecting and worming their way into the social lives of their children, even in high school. And Facebook has given us a new level on which moms can do that, and the kids even have a word for that. They call it, she's a creeper. She's a Facebook creeper. She's spying on people and all of that. She's overly attentive. She's overly engaged. Now, her motives are not sinister. She wants to be connected. She wants to know what's going on. And it's subtle, but even the kids know there's something that's wrong with that. They're too involved. They're too engaged. They're too concerned about their kids missing an opportunity. I remember as we passed into middle school, one of the deals that that we would go through is as we passed into middle school, our boys had to take responsibility for all of their academic work, which meant that my wife had to stop taking any responsibility for their academic work. So she quit going through their book bags on the first day of school when they came home with their syllabus or their little manual, whatever it was that had all the projects they were going to have for that semester. She couldn't take that and put it on the family calendar. It was his responsibility to handle all of that. And it was a very difficult transition for my wife to make. Because here's what was going on in her mind. She was thinking, he's got a chance to be in honors classes. We want to make sure he gets in honors classes, because if he doesn't get in honors classes, he might end up just being in classes with normal kids. And we all know that normal kids smoke dope, because they do. Normal kids smoke dope. He might be in a class, sit beside a normal kid who doesn't really care about his schoolwork the way the honors kids do, who are trying to get a college scholarship, which college scholarship, not as worried about all that. But if you sit beside a kid smoking dope, maybe one day he goes out with him after school and he smokes dope. Then if he smokes dope and he gets hooked, then he's got a habit, and before you know it, he's got a relationship with a dealer and he starts selling dope in order to, he becomes a pusher in order to feed his habit, and then he's arrested, he's got a felony drug charge, and the rest of his life is down the tubes. And she would never say any of that. But somewhere in the back of her mind, those kind of fears are looming because, remember, she's been a life factor. She's provided everything that he's needed. She feels his need of her, as he gets older, she feels like he needs her more than he actually does need her. And it actually guts him. It makes him feel like she doesn't trust him, she doesn't think he's capable of handling his responsibilities. And the reality is, he may not handle his responsibilities. He might, we had to go through this thing. Well, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? Well, he's going to get a zero. And I'm like, well, he gets a zero, and then we ruin his life for about 6 weeks, and then he'll think, I probably shouldn't get a zero again. But it's really difficult, way easier for me to allow that to happen. And it looks like love, and it feels like love to her, but to him it feels like control, it feels like disrespect. And so just another simple illustration. One time, we had a good friend, single woman, whose parents were in a car accident. They were hurt real badly. We had to fly into action. We went and met her. She rode with her parents to the hospital. We got to the emergency room and waiting with her. and she had left a vehicle somewhere else, and it was in a location where my sons were not real familiar. I called my oldest on the phone and told him, I said, you go get your friend, and I want you guys to drive up to this area. Here's what the car looks like. Here's the general area where it's parked. I need you to find it. There's a key under the mat. You get the key out from under the mat. Then I need you to drive it to this other hospital, which is about 30 miles away. Now, they had never been to any of those places. I gave them directions. I said, you got my cell number? You call me if you need anything. Well, my wife was beside herself the whole time that they were doing all of that. What if they get lost? What if this? What if that happens? They may not know. They might miss. Maybe they need to do this. I was like, babe, I told them to call me if they need me. Let's just wait. She's like, well, we're in the hospital. You might not get their phone call. I was like, well, then they'll call somebody else that they can get. Call the other boy's dad. It'll get worked out. I just need you to leave them alone. Don't call them. And she could not bring herself to let that go. And it was when I realized in the middle of all of that, she actually snuck out of the room. She'd had me telling the story. She snuck out of the room. She went around the corner, went outside, and she called him. And then she came back in, and she had this really guilty look on her face. I said, you went outside and called him, didn't you? And she's like, yes, I did. I'm so sorry. It's one of the few times that she would do something like that. But it was so, she was so concerned about their ability to get this thing done. I had to take her aside. I had to say, baby, here's what I need you to understand. When I talk to him like a man and I treat him like a man, I said, bro, I just need you to go handle that. Go get that done. We got this woman who's in a difficult situation. Go take care of her. And I give him general direction. What I'm communicating to him is, you can do this. I believe you're a man. I said, and when you call him and check up on him, what you're saying is, I don't believe you can do this, and you need your mommy to take care of you. And she's like, that's not what I'm saying at all. I was like, right, but that's what he's hearing. And so to her, it felt like love, but to him, it felt like control, and you are weak, and ultimately, it undermines his ability to think of himself as a man, and it's so powerful that it can shape and warp the masculine psyche. Those are some of the characteristics, those are some of the illustrations for how that can happen. Now, what are the sources of this wound? Where does it come from? Now, if you'll notice in those conversations, and this is why I'm so thankful for Men's Roundtable, because it's given me a language to operate within my home. And I might have had some of those gut impulses and instincts, but I would not have had the strength, and I would not have had the clarity to really engage my wife and help push back on her to create some space for my boys if I hadn't had this kind of language. So it's why I'm so glad you're here and you're being a part of this. Because where this wound begins is actually with us as fathers, as men. The wound begins with an absent or a distant father. It begins with a dad who is not willing to enter into the fray and to push back on his wife and create some room for his son to fail and begin to move from boyhood to manhood to find his own strength, his own gifts. The only way you can do that is by taking some risks. And if you have an absent or a distant father, a father who is not close enough, that he is willing then to really engage. We could just say a passive father. It may be a dad who's actually there and who's in the room, but who does not have the courage to take his wife on. I remember in the early stage when my oldest son, we were a little behind on all of this, but when my oldest son was first beginning to feel like a man, I mean, as soon as the testosterone starts flowing, he starts to think like a man. He's just a really immature man, but he's not a boy anymore. And we start seeing this escalation of conflict with his mom. We were homeschooling at the time, so he was with her a lot. And I started seeing this conflict that was going on, and I was pounding him about respecting his mom. And then one day he just broke down in tears, and I asked him a handful of questions, and I realized he was being wounded by her. He was feeling disrespected by her. And there was this moment where I realized, holy cow, I'm gonna have to go push back on my wife. And she's going to feel like I'm betraying her. So I remember I took her out to dinner. We went to a nice dinner, and which normally ends pretty well for me, if I'm being honest about it. And there are benefits for that kind of thing. And it was going great, and I was totally being a wimp because we went through the whole night, and I didn't even bring it up. And I was thinking, how am I going to start this conversation? How am I going to start this conversation? And I remember where we were on Three Bridge Road, and then we turned off on Brushy Creek Road, and I waited until we were about a mile from our house before I had the guts to bring it up with her. And I brought it up with her, and I used the illustration of ancient tribal cultures and how they would come kidnap a boy and take him away from his mom and scar him, and it did not go well. I lost a ton of credibility. She got furious with me. We had a big fight, and we had about 6 months of conflict because I wasn't yet clear and didn't have good language for some of these things. But I could not be absent in that moment. And here's what I realized, because I saw two things happening. One is I saw my son being frustrated in our home, and I felt like we were losing him in some ways. And secondly, I realized he's going to hate his mom. He ain't going to want to have anything to do with her. He ain't going to want to have a relationship. He ain't going to want to call her. He's going to look forward when he goes to college. He will be so happy to be out from underneath her, and she is going to hate that because she really loves him. That's not what she wants to happen. So I had to enter into the middle of this thing and be willing to encounter a lot of conflict. I had to be willing to have my sex life affected by engaging in protecting and creating some space for my son. I had to be willing to say the wrong thing in order to create room for my son to become a man. And so it begins with us. And that's just the way that God's made it. Just like in Genesis 2, it begins with us. The solution is going to begin with us as well. It begins with an absent or a distant father. The second thing that we could say is that when dad is passive or steps back, this wound is inflicted by, and I'll just give you a handful of categories here, a fill-in-the-gap mom, an ignorant mom, an aggressive mom, an unwilling to release mom. I mean, those are just categories that we're kind of making up, but we're looking at the range of expressions. The fill-in-the-gap mom is the mom who's trying to make up for the deficits that she sees with her husband. She sees places where he's not really engaging, and so she becomes hyper-vigilant and over-attentive, and she pours more and more energy into him. The difficulty is the kind of energy that she has cannot produce healthy masculinity. It's actually having the reverse effect. And so the more she tries to fill in the gap, the greater that gap becomes. An ignorant mom, just a mom who, an ignorant in the sense of just not being aware, not even thinking about this. I was talking to one of our women one day, and she's like, oh yeah, I mean, I understand all of that. I understand. I read a book about boys and blah, 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 blah. And she's just totally gutting his masculinity. And she just didn't know. She thought because she read a book, she knew some things. She didn't know some things. She didn't have any experience being a man. She didn't understand how disrespectful she was being to her son, and he didn't have a language to say, Mom, you're disrespecting me and treating me like I'm weak. He didn't know how to say any of that. He didn't have a language for it. She didn't have a language for it. She was just ignorant. And so that's part of what we have to do is we have to communicate. We have to be social leaders as men. We have to engage. We have to inform our women. That's a big part of what our Azair study is trying to do, is to create some language that can be used to help our women be more aware. An aggressive mom. Some moms are just wired up to be more intense. And if you're married to a woman who is like that, then that's great for you. It probably means that you're more laid back. Rarely do you see two aggressive people get hitched up. It probably means you're more laid back, which means there's going to be a challenge for you because you're going to have to be backing her down because her instinct is going to be to leap forward. And she's going to have to see you moving forward more than her so that she can relax and let some things go. And then the last thing, the unwilling to release mom. And this is a real challenge where, especially if you have a single mom who has some big wounds and deficits of her own because she's not been pursued by her husband, not been protected and provided for the way she wants to, a lot of times what will happen is that there begins to be this twisting of a relationship with the son, especially if his personality is wired up in a certain way, that he begins to fill in that need for her. And so the idea for her that he is going to detach from her as a boy, he's going to go away and build a life as a man, and they're going to have a new, more distant relationship, but a really rewarding friendship with him as another man, but he's not going to belong to her anymore. That is death to her. And she's in a real position of vulnerability and weakness because she depends on him. In some ways, she feels like he completes her. She can't see the line between her and him as being a clear line. It's a porous boundary. And she feels like her life is tied to his life. And so she can't release. And that in and of itself is devastating to his ability to ever connect with another woman and to be married and to have a healthy marriage. So the critical need today, if you look at your notes on the second page, the critical need today is for fathers to engage and to call their sons away from their moms and toward manhood. Away from their moms and toward manhood. Now, it doesn't mean, now as I'm saying this, and I know there are going to be women who are listening to this, she's saying boys don't need to have a relationship with their mom. That's not at all what I'm saying. What I'm saying is he's got to go away as a boy and come back to her as a man. So that's why a dad has to call a son towards manhood, because then as a man, he can come back and frame a new relationship with his mom. And this is the great thing about growing older is I've been through this. And I've watched what's happened. My oldest son that we spoke about, who was really struggling to have any kind of relationship with my wife when he was 13 and 14 years old, they are tight, tight, tight friends now. They communicate all the time. He initiates communication with her. He loves to spend time with her. He talks about her. We had two girls that he goes to college with the other day who were over at our house for dinner because they're in a small group with my wife that she's leading in our women's study, our Azair study. And they're there. And one of the things those girls were talking about is how he talks about his mom. They were telling her, Foster talks about you all the time, about how cool you are, how he loves you. Unsolicited, this is what they're saying, which is just music to my wife's ears. I mean, she was just sailing after that conversation. She didn't ask about it. She wasn't prying in, trying to get that information. That's what they volunteered. And it stands out to those two girls. But now he's a man who really loves his mom and doesn't feel threatened or controlled by her. But in order for that transition to happen, dad has to create space, and then he's got to call that boy towards manhood. And dad has to do that. Mom cannot do that. And where there's not a dad there, the community of men and the church have to do that. It's a big responsibility of our student ministry. And here's some things about that call. That call needs to be direct. It needs to be direct. It needs to be directional with him, and that we are moving now from one category to another. I'm there with my youngest son now. Just the way we talk about him getting ready for school in the morning. I was able to say to him, just even one day this past week, I was able to say to him, bro, here's the thing. Here's what's wrong with this. I am supplying energy to get you to do what is your responsibility. It's not my job to get you ready for school. That's your job. I pulled the guilt card. I hate to say it, but I did. I pulled the guilt card. I said, I got up this morning at 5 o'clock because I got a big day. I got lots of meetings. I had work to do. I got up. I was studying. I got a leg up on all my stuff. I finished all of that. I fixed your lunch because your mom's not feeling well. She's sick. I prepared your lunch for you, and I cooked breakfast for you, and I got myself ready, and I'm getting us to school. Is it right that I should be carrying that weight for you? I need this time for you. You're not a little boy anymore. I need you to be more of a man. You have a limited range of responsibilities. I don't mind doing the other things that I'm doing for you. That's part of my deal. That's where I am. But I need you to carry what's yours to carry. I need you to think more like a man. Quit thinking so much like a boy. It's direct. It's in the moment. But it's also got to be specific, because otherwise he'll just feel like he's being beaten up. It's got to be specific. And here's what we mean by specific. It needs to include a masculine vision. He needs to have an idea about what a real man is. Because the culture is telling him being a real man is sexual conquest. Being a real man is making a lot of money. Being a real man is being a great athlete. Being a real man is telling him all these images. We have to give him a masculine vision to describe what a real man is. We've got to show him examples of it. We've got to watch movies with him and talk to him about it. They didn't get all of that right, but look at that thing right there in the middle of it. Look at how he gave his life for those other people. He took the pain of evil and injustice on himself so that those people could have shade to live in. You're creating a vision, and that vision needs to be a motive, and it needs to be creative, and it needs to be something that he feels in his bones and he aspires to. The specificity of this means that he needs to have a code of conduct to demonstrate how a real man lives. He needs to reject passivity. He needs to accept responsibility. He needs to lead courageously. What does that look like for him? What does that code of conduct look like for him with his own unique gifts and at his season of life? What does it look like for him when a little girl's being picked on who has a learning disability in the hallway and there's nobody there to stop it? What does it look like to be a man? What is a code of conduct? What do we expect him to do? He needs to be equipped in that moment. And so I'm not saying you got to do it this way in your family, but in our family, we talk about fighting. We don't fight to protect ourselves, but there are times where it may be necessary to use physical violence in order to protect other people and to show them that they have value. And so in that moment, in our family, this is what we taught our boys. What it means for you to accept responsibility, to reject passivity, accept responsibility, and lead courageously in that moment is you are responsible for this young girl who is being picked on. And you need to step between her and the injustice that she's experiencing, and you need to then take that on to yourself and absorb that. And if that will get it done, then it's done. Because you can handle somebody calling you a retard. That isn't the end of the world for you. You take that, and you just take it. You turn the other cheek and let it go. But if they won't stop, then here's what you do. You tell them, you need to stop talking, or I'm going to stop you from talking. And this is when their eyes start getting big when you're having this conversation. Middle school boy, he's like, whoo, it's getting interesting. And when you tell them to stop talking, or you're going to stop them, if their ego gets involved and they don't let it go, then here's what you need to do. You need to make sure you're right-handed, right? Right. Yeah, Dad, I'm right-handed. You know I'm right-handed. Okay, then your left leg needs to be forward, your back leg needs to be like this, and your hips need to be at about a 30 to 45 degree angle. Because here's what we're going to do. We're going to take our strong hand, we're going to make sure our thumb is outside of our fist, and we're going to throw a haymaker over the top into his nose right here. That's what we're doing. And by this time, their eyes are huge. Because we're taking responsibility. This girl needs to know she's made in the image of God and she has value. And he's like, you want me to hit him? I'm like, I want you to hit him really hard. And then after you hit him really hard, you need to look, because if anybody's going to jump on you, it's going to be the guy who's behind him. And he's like, well, then I'll get thrown out of school. I was like, yep, and I'll go to the school board meeting with you. And we'll work our way through it. But that little girl will know for the rest of her life that she has dignity that's worth being suffered for. That there are men in the world who value her. That's a code of conduct that's got to then be applied in a context. It's even a code of conduct when you're talking about turning the other cheek. You're saying, you can handle that. It's part of what you're wired up to do. Jesus turned the other cheek. He suffered for other people to protect them. That's what we're going to do. But sometimes you have to stop it. And when you have to stop it, here's how you do it. The last piece. It's a transcendent cause. He needs a specific call, this masculine vision, a code of conduct to demonstrate how a real man lives, and then a transcendent cause to declare what a real man lives for. And for us, we're living for the glory of God, to reject passivity, to accept responsibility, to lead courageously in expectation of God's reward. We're living for God's approval, not for the approval of others. We're on his mission. And then here's the last thing. This call needs to employ ceremony. If we are going to raise up a generation of young men who have a healthy masculinity, then it means that we're going to have to step into the gap. It means we're going to have to lead with our wives, and we're going to have to argue for them to have some space, in, or for our boys to have some space in order to transition into being men. We're going to have to give our young boys a vision for what that looks like. And you are going to be in the middle of all of that. Now, here's the thing. If you're sitting here and you're like, ah, I've got this mother wound just in huge and devastating ways. That's why we're gonna go into conversation and in small group now. It's an opportunity for you to self-identify. It's an opportunity for you to engage some other men on what it's going to look like for you to move from being underneath that wound to having some freedom. It's going to mean that you're going to have to establish some boundaries with your mom. It's going to mean that you're going to have to do all the things that we're talking about doing with your wife. You're going to have to do that with your mom. You're going to have to create some room. You're going to have to explain to her, this has to stop here. You're going to have to move out of that. You're going to have to engage other men in helping you in all of that. And only you can do that. But you're going to need help while you go about doing it. So as you go to your groups, as you begin to work through these questions, you begin to think about what this looks like in moving forward in the next generation, and then even looking back and healing this in your own life, that's what we need you to see. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for what you've done for us in and through your son, Jesus. I want to pray that you would be with us as men. Give us courage to confront what we're facing and give us wisdom to know how to move forward with it. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.